KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. The Trump administration has slashed federal research dollars from the National Institutes of Health. What could that mean for U.S. universities and their research? That's coming up on Morning Edition from NPR News. Even though Republicans have a majority in Congress, the two chambers have different ideas of how to execute Trump's agenda. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. We look at why Republicans are so divided and how they could reconcile. Also, a new documentary explores the career of funk father Sly Stone and what its creator says are the different set of rules for success for black artists. And we ask, how likely are we to make it to Mars in the next 4 years? It's Wednesday, February 12th. Actor Josh Brolin is 57 years old today. News headlines are next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. American teacher Mark Fogel has been released from a Russian prison and has returned to the U.S. He was detained in 2021 for carrying medical marijuana. President Trump welcomed Fogel to the White House yesterday. Trump's special envoy, Steve Witkoff, helped secure Fogel's release.
Mark languished there for 3.5 years, and he shouldn't have. He should have been out, you know, before. But he's out now. His family's grateful. He is as happy a human being as you're going to find, as the country will find out. Mm-hmm. And he's extraordinarily grateful to the president, our president, President Trump, and also to President Putin.
He spoke to CNN. Russia says that in exchange, the U.S. has released a Russian citizen who has been imprisoned in the U.S. It is not known publicly who that person is. The Trump administration is slashing the budget of the General Services Administration in half. Those cuts could affect nearly all federal properties and contracts. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin reports that's according to sources who spoke to NPR on condition of anonymity, fearing further retribution from the Trump administration.
The General Services Administration manages federal real estate across the country, as well as nearly all federal contracts. Without it, federal agencies would have a lot of trouble buying things and providing essential public services. However, GSA employees have been told their budget is being cut by 50%, spread across contracts, leases, and personnel salaries. Employees who remain and who don't take a deferred resignation offer will be subject to heightened surveillance, including installation of what's called a key logger, software that tracks everything the user types. It could be the model for the rest of the federal government going forward. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
Stocks opened sharply lower this morning as the Labor Department reported higher than expected inflation last month. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 380 points in early trading.
Forecasters had expected to see some moderation in price hikes last month, but inflation remains stubbornly high. Consumer prices in January were up 3% from a year ago. Prices rose by 0.5% between December and January alone. Egg prices jumped more than 15% last month after avian flu forced egg farmers to cull millions of laying hens in December. Overall, grocery prices were up by 0.5%. Stripping out food and energy prices, which bounce around a lot, core inflation was also higher than forecasters had expected. Given the sticky price hikes, the Federal Reserve is expected to take its time before making any additional cuts to interest rates. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is threatening to resume hostilities in Gaza if Hamas does not release three hostages by Saturday. That's supposed to be in accordance with the ceasefire. This week, Hamas had said it was delaying the hostages' release and then blamed Israel for violating the ceasefire. It's NPR. The White House has fired the Inspector General of the agency USAID. That happened one day after Inspector General Paul Martin's office released a critical report on President Trump's work to dismantle the agency. The report says this makes it pretty much impossible for the agency to monitor more than $8 billion in unspent humanitarian aid. That means the aid could fall into the wrong hands. Most countries have missed a key United Nations deadline to submit plans to fight climate change. NPR's Julia Simon reports only a few countries made it on time.
As part of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, nearly 200 countries agreed to submit targets for reducing their climate pollution by 2035. The hope is that all these cuts combined will limit the world's warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. Earlier this week was the deadline for countries to submit these targets. Only a dozen countries met the deadline. One of those countries was the U.S. The U.S. submitted a climate target right before Biden left office. Trump then pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement. The hard deadline is in September. Climate experts say they'll be especially looking to see how ambitious China and the European Union are with their cuts to climate pollution. Julia Simon, NPR News.
Forecasters say another winter storm is going to pummel much of the U.S. The National Weather Service says heavy snow will fall from the Central Plains into the Great Lakes and New England by Friday. In the south, the danger is from thunderstorms and heavy rain. Forecasters say there's a risk of hail and even tornadoes across much of the southeast. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. Coming up, we hear about how a major rainstorm expected to hit the Los Angeles area starting today could affect cleanup following the recent wildfires. But first,
top officials from the Trump administration are in Europe this week.
They're there for talks their counterparts hope will shed light on U.S. policy on Ukraine, commitment to NATO, and other transatlantic issues.
Terry Schultz reports from Brussels, where Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth meets allies today. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning, Leila.
So just walk us through who's going where and why.
Yeah, it's a busy week in transatlantic relations. And just to start off, Leila, I have to note that as his officials were on the way to Europe, President Trump went ahead with announcing 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. So Europeans may have been smiling through gritted teeth as they welcomed their American counterparts here. But in sum, the travel plans look like this. Vice President J.D. Vance spoke yesterday at an international summit on artificial intelligence in Paris. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is here at NATO today to join a meeting of some 50 countries that support Ukraine after he met U.S. troops in Germany yesterday. And Friday, Vance will be joined by Secretary of State Marco Rubio and members of Congress for the biggest annual foreign policy gathering in Europe, the Munich Security Conference.
Okay, so quite a lineup there, Terry. Mm-hmm. What are their main messages for the European partners?
Well, it ranges, obviously, based on the venue and the audience. In Paris, with leaders from Europe and Asia in attendance, Vice President Vance asserted Washington will be dominant in crucial ways, including production of the all-important microchips. He warned Europe it should drop its focus on regulation, which has meant investigations into American companies, including Elon Musk's X platform, and has meant fines on some of them, such as Google, which Trump has blasted publicly as unfair. While he was in Germany, Hegseth gave a preview of what he'll say at NATO.
This kind of urgency of this moment requires friends talking to friends, about capabilities, about leadership, about stepping up, about burden sharing, but it ought be those in the neighborhood investing the most in that collective, individual and collective defense.
Okay, so what will NATO allies hear and take away from remarks like that?
Well, first off, I'm sure they're relieved he describes this as friends talking to friends. And I'm not even joking. Europeans are so on edge here, wondering if Trump's well-known animosity toward NATO in his first term will carry over. Added to that now, remember, are these Trump threats against two NATO allies, that he may seize Greenland, which is a territory of Denmark, and that he wants Canada to become the 51st state. Diplomats tell me those issues are not expected to be raised here, in part because they're so inflammatory and no one wants to torpedo this first meeting. So back to Hegseth's remark on burden sharing, this is exactly what Europeans are expecting to hear. They'll explain that they are increasing their investments. 23 of 32 countries now spend 2% of their GDP on defense. That's NATO's old target. They're expecting Hegseth to repeat Trump's new demand that this be raised to 5%.
And what about concerns that the U.S. will pull out military support from Europe?
That's particularly important for those countries along the front line of the war in Ukraine. But Hegseth was also fairly reassuring about that yesterday. Let's have a listen.
We would be remiss in not reviewing force posture everywhere, but it would be the wrong planning assumption to say, oh, America's abandoning something or America's leaving.
Now, that doesn't mean there won't be decisions to move some U.S. troops, but he seems to be trying to tamp down fears of anything abrupt. If these are the kind of things he repeats at NATO over the next 2 days, allies will be relieved. And the fact that he's attending this Ukraine Defense Contact Group meeting today is also reassuring. They'd be happy to see Hegseth lead the group, which was set up by his predecessor Lloyd Austin, but they weren't sure if he'd even come. So I think they'll be considering this a good start.
Okay. Terry Schultz in Brussels. Thank you, Terry.
You're welcome.
How would funding cuts the National Institutes of Health affect research institutions? A policy now on hold in court would cap federal support for overhead costs. Universities in Alabama, North Carolina, Iowa, Michigan, all over the country, in fact, are warning this could disrupt critical research. Holden Thorpe is here to talk about this. He's editor-in-chief of the journal Science. So, Holden, first tell us a bit about how and why government money ends up at educational institutions in the first place.
Right. So, about 70 years ago, after World War II, the United States decided that instead of building its own research buildings and hiring its own scientists, that it wanted to carry out the national research effort at the universities. And the idea behind this was mainly that the professors carrying out the research would be more independent and come up with more creative ideas than if they were directed by the government. But this is a costly thing to do, so the institutions and the government decided they would roughly split the costs of providing the laboratories and accounting for the grants and making sure they manage all the complicated things like waste disposal and stuff like that. So the federal government's contribution to that social contract comes in the indirect cost portion of the grant, which is the fraction of the direct costs that they're contributing. And that's where these confusing numbers come from. But the easy way to think about it is that the institutions and the government have been splitting roughly 50-50 the cost of building the research enterprise in the United States.
It's interesting, Holden, that you called it a social contract. Why'd you use that term?
Well, because it's not exactly, I mean, it is codified in various laws, which the court responded to yesterday, but it's more or less just an agreement that the institutions will carry out the federal research enterprise with this arrangement of sharing the infrastructure costs of doing it.
Now, you used to be the chancellor at UNC Chapel Hill and the provost of Washington University in St. Louis. Both institutions receive money from the NIH. What kind of financial trade-offs would administrators have to consider under this policy?
Well, there are a lot of numbers floating around from different institutions as to how much they would be cut, but a lot of the larger ones would have to find $150, even $200 million every year to replace the money that they're getting from the federal government. And so the choices that they have are all pretty bleak. They'd have to cut other programs in order to fill that hole in, which could affect any discipline or any function of the university, or they would have to cut corners and the way they administer the research, which could create all kinds of problems with accounting or non-compliance with the government regulations. And I think one important thing for people to realize is that A lot of this money is spent to make sure that the funds are administered according to the regulations that the federal government itself has set. These are not all regulations that the university has set.
Yeah, and those numbers you were talking about, Holden, sound a little too much just to fundraise to try and cover, right?
It would really be hard to get philanthropy to pay that, not just because it's a large number, but also because these aren't exactly functions, you know, waste disposal or paying for grants administrators that donors get very excited about funding.
Now, the NIH pointed out this policy would bring it more in line with private foundations, which pay less than the government for indirect costs. And the NIH said the change would assure that more money would go directly to research rather than overhead. Holden, do those arguments hold water for you?
I understand where those arguments are coming from. As far as the foundations are concerned, I think the difference there is that those foundations were not part of the social contract that led to the development of the federal research enterprise. And in a way, those funds are actually defraying additional funds for direct costs that the federal government might have had to provide to do the same research. And so it is an awkward fact about all of this, but I think the reason for it is just that these are recent developments.
Holden Thorpe of the journal Science and also chemistry professor at the George Washington University. Holden, thank you very much.
Great being on with you.
Phase two of wildfire cleanup efforts are underway in Los Angeles. Thousands of sites have been cleared of hazardous materials like solvents and lithium-ion batteries. Attention now turns to clearing debris like wood, metal, and ash. But there's a problem. A major rainstorm is on the way. Jacob Margolis from member station LAist reports.
The National Weather Service says the rainstorm is expected to arrive on Wednesday and last until Friday. But it's Thursday afternoon that's the period of greatest concern, because that's when more than half an inch of rain could fall in 1 hour, enough to trigger debris flows in recently burned areas. Ariel Cohen is a meteorologist with the NWS and warned of the storm at a press conference on Tuesday.
Given the elevated chances for significant debris flows consisting of raging torrents of rock slides and mudslides that can be damaging and even deadly, now is the time to start getting prepared for these potentially dangerous conditions.
There could be other hazards as well. Even after light rain last month, there may still be lead, arsenic, and other heavy metals in ash at burn sites. That's according to researchers at the University of Southern California who've been doing initial testing. When rains fall, heavy metals can percolate deeper into soils on properties and can get carried with all sorts of other junk into sewers and out into the ocean. Annalisa Moe is the Associate Director of Science and Policy at Heal the Bay, an environmental nonprofit.
Each time that it rains, at least for the next several months, we're going to see spikes in these contaminants again.
Her organization is taking regular water samples. Just recently, she was on the coast after the first rainstorm since the fires.
It really looked like chocolate milk with, you know, chunks of fire debris like ash in it and a really persistent brownish foam that indicates higher presence of nutrients.
Those nutrients, which can come from burning vegetation, feed algae and can lead to algal blooms, which can be toxic to seabirds and marine mammals like sea lions. And the heavy metals can enter the food web and make seafood less safe to eat. It'll take some time for researchers to know the full impact of these fires on California soils and waterways. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Margolis in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Thank you. on the next Fresh Air, how Elon Musk got and is using the power to cut jobs / federal funding and help place people close to him in government positions. What influence are other tech billionaires having on the Trump administration? We'll talk with New York Times reporter Teddy Schleifer, who covers the intersection of Washington's players and tech titans. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/IULab. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Oscar and Grammy-winning musician and filmmaker Amir Questlove Thompson focuses his latest documentary on funk musician Sly Stone.
Sly was the creator,
writer,
innovator,
poet, genius.
When it came together, the sound, it was so future.
Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius, begins streaming on Hulu tomorrow. NPR's Manolita El Barco spoke with Questlove at the Sundance Film Festival about his new film.
Questlove was in his zone as a DJ at the turntables for the Sly Lives premiere party at Sundance. 4 years ago, the festival was virtual during the COVID-19 pandemic, so he wasn't able to premiere his first film in person. That documentary, Summer of Soul, went on to win an Academy Award. This year, Amir Thompson was at Sundance with an audience.
Yeah, as an Oscar winner.
It's a hell of a victory lap.
The Sundance crowd went wild for Thompson's latest film about the charismatic, enigmatic 1970s funk master Sylvester Stewart, better known as Sly Stone.
I am everyday people.
Thompson says he was a complicated provocateur.
Bless his heart, like Sly actually tried to go to taboo territory, put together this intersectional, interracial band, women, men, black, white. Sly has 1 foot in San Francisco with all the hippies and 1 foot in Oakland with all the gangsters.
Using archival clips, the film charts Sly Stone's rise from a Bay Area DJ to wild years with his band, The Family Stone, navigating fame before spiraling into drug addiction. The documentary opens with a clip from a 1982 interview with journalist Maria Shriver.
You were at the place that every musician wants to be. Get there and you blow it.
Thompson says that question was rather harsh.
Audacious, bold, no holds barred, band-aid ripping method of talking to him. But I also secretly agree with her. You know, like, you could have picked a more nuanced way to ask that. But that's also like the main reason why I did the film. It's like, why do we keep self-sabotaging?
Thompson says telling Sly Stone's story with empathy was a way for him to open a conversation about black artists and mental health. He talks to Sly's former bandmates and collaborators like Jimmy Jam, Chaka Khan, and Vernon Reid, and some of Sly Stone's disciples, including D'Angelo and Andre 3000.
Do you believe in the concept of black genius?
Black genius?
Wow.
The Burden of Black Genius is the subtitle of the documentary. It's something Thompson says he's thought a lot about. He says, upon reflection, there's a different set of rules for success for black artists.
The main question of the film is, like, is success scarier than failing? Now, we really have a fear of succeeding because that means that you're going to be alone and isolated and separated from what you know. And either you're going to be away so long that when you come back, you're going to change and then really alienate your home base, or you won't be able to take them with you. And if you do take them with you, that becomes burdensome.
Questlove also breaks down Sly Stone's music and his influence on other artists, including many who have sampled his beats.
It's a family affair. It's a family affair.
you really see Questlove's DJ skills come into play.
Novena Carmel is a DJ at NPR member station KCRW in Los Angeles. She's also Sly Stone's daughter.
I think that he could tell that Questlove is truly a musician, a music lover, and approaches him in the story with respect. Questlove could also see a lot of himself in my dad, in a way, you know, as a musician and as a black man in the world.
Carmel says her father, Sly Stone, is now 81 years old and living quietly in the valley.
I'm just happy that he's here and that he's clean and he gets to enjoy his family and feel the love that he's going to get from this documentary.
If you want me to stay, I'll be around today.
Next up for Questlove is a documentary about the band Earth, Wind & Fire. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
Today marks 25 years since the death of Charles Schulz, the creator of Charlie Brown, Snoopy and Friends from the Peanuts comic strip. When it premiered in 1950, Schulz said he didn't think it would last long. Here he is on Morning Edition back in 1995.
Peanuts was originally sold as a space-saving comic strip. At the time, it was probably the smallest comic strip around. I've always said there was no room for adults because if they had stood up, they would have bumped their heads on the top of the panel.
But the strip did more than just survive. Eventually, the Peanuts gang was everywhere. T-shirts, lunchboxes, Macy's parade balloons. NASA even named two Apollo 10 spacecraft after Peanuts characters. They flew a mission to the moon in 1969.
We copy, Charlie Brown.
Okay, Charlie Brown, this is Snoopy.
Stand by.
Benjamin Clark is the curator of the Charles Schulz Museum in Santa Rosa, California. He says at its peak, the Peanuts comic strip had 100 million daily readers, and key to the strip's popularity was that the characters expressed emotion.
The newspaper comic strips that Schulz grew up reading were nothing like this. Schulz was so revolutionary in being so emotionally honest.
Now, some of that emotion, Schulz says, was derived from his own childhood growing up in Minneapolis in the 1920s.
There were episodes in our neighborhood where there were some cruel children, and it's very difficult out there in the playground to survive.
Benjamin Clark's favorite Peanuts cartoon features a very subtle display of emotion.
Linus is turning the crank on a jack-in-the-box. A little doll pops out of the jack-in-the-box. A little heart appears above Linus's head, and he says, "I fall in love too easy." And we know it in an instant. What these characters are feeling, I think that is an enormous part of why it still resonates 75 years after it began.
He credits Gen Z and social media for the comic strip's latest bump in popularity.
You know, they're using it to make memes, and they're able to use it in fashion and design, and they're doing fun stuff with it. And it's really interesting to see where this creative drive and this influence and inspiration will take everyone.
Which might explain why the museum is jam-packed with visitors.
We are having record numbers, far higher than we've seen in our 22-year history.
Charles Schulz died on this day 25 years ago. This is NPR News.
If you've ever felt the urge to tune out the world's crises, you have something in common with the narrator of the new novel, Stone Yard Devotional.
It's something that has really preoccupied me as a writer, that the question of how much should I be in the world, how much should I be out of the world.
I'm Ari Shapiro. What do we owe the world and each other? On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A Pennsylvania school teacher held in a Russian prison for more than 3 years was at the White House last night to meet with President Trump. Mark Fogel was freed by Russia hours earlier in a deal negotiated by the Trump administration. The Kremlin says in exchange, the U.S. released a Russian citizen who'd been behind bars. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, the State Department says Fogel had been wrongly detained.
With an American flag draped over his shoulder, Fogel expressed gratitude to all those who worked to bring him home.
I feel like the luckiest man on earth right now.
Trump wouldn't say whether he had spoken to Russian President Vladimir Putin directly, but said the deal securing Fogel's release was very, very fair.
It could be a big, important part of getting the war over with Ukraine. And we appreciate President Putin's what he did. He was able to pull it off for you, right? He was able to pull it off. We think, and you're here.
Trump said he wants to, quote, get the war ended. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Fogel was convicted of drug charges in Russia for possessing medical marijuana. The Senate is expected to vote this morning on President Trump's nomination of Tulsi Gabbard to be Director of National Intelligence. This is NPR News from Washington. The Inspector General for the U.S. Agency for International Development has been fired by the White House. Paul Martin was let go a day after his office issued a report critical of the Trump administration's push to eliminate the agency. A federal judge is ordering federal health agencies to restore websites and data sets that were pulled down beginning late last month. As NPR's Will Stone reports, the order is in response to a lawsuit filed by the progressive advocacy group Doctors for America.
The sudden removal of data led to an outcry from across the medical and public health fields. Now the court is ordering the government to bring the missing information back online. The judge said the sudden loss of resources had jeopardized the work of clinicians, ultimately harming Americans seeking health care. The pages that are set to be revived include everything from information about HIV testing and prevention to guidance on contraceptives to plans for increasing enrollment of underrepresented populations in clinical trials. The Department of Health and Human Services did not respond to requests for comment. Previously, a CDC spokesperson cited President Trump's executive orders as the rationale for removing or modifying the websites. Will Stone, NPR News.
Inflation in the U.S. economy accelerated in January as costs for groceries, gasoline, and vehicles went up. Consumer prices rose by 3% compared to the same month a year earlier. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, supporting creative people and effective institutions committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is at macfound.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California. Congressional Republicans want to boost security along the southern border and extend tax cuts passed in the first Trump administration. But even with united government, the devil is in the details. The House and Senate are moving forward with competing plans, all while a government shutdown is quickly approaching next month without much clarity that both parties can come together on a deal. NPR congressional correspondent Barbara Sprunt is following all this. So, Barbara, if lawmakers agree on what should happen from a policy perspective, why so much disagreement?
Well, the Senate wants to start with one bill on the border, energy and defense, and then later do a second bill that's focused on taxes. And the reason why is that they're concerned that adding in the tax elements now would make it too complicated to pass quickly. Senate Budget Chairman Lindsey Graham spoke yesterday about the need for urgent action after a closed-door briefing with OMB Director Russ Vogt and Border Czar Tom Homan. Graham says they were begging for more funding and said that Immigrations and Customs Enforcement is running out of money. The Senate Budget Committee plans to mark up a budget resolution that would begin the process of a reconciliation bill that would provide $175 billion to the border. Here's Graham.
It would be enough money for 4 years to implement President Trump's border agenda, immigration agenda on the security side.
Now, this plan is at odds with what House leadership wants, which is one single bill encompassing energy, the border, tax cuts. And Graham addressed his counterparts directly.
To my friends in the House, we're moving because we have to. I wish you the best. I want one big, beautiful bill. But I cannot and I will not go back to South Carolina and justify not supporting the president's immigration plan.
So why does the House want to move forward with just one bill? What's that argument?
Well, they're worried that if they delay the tax component and put it in a second bill down the road, it could be jeopardized altogether. House Republicans have a razor-thin majority, and it's hard enough, frankly, to satisfy all factions to get on board with one bill, let alone two. That said, the conference isn't yet fully aligned on all of the particulars here, and the speaker's plan was already undermined earlier this week when the House Freedom Caucus released its own proposal, which was a two-bill approach.
Yeah, now, budget reconciliation, you mentioned that. What exactly does that mean?
Well, reconciliation, very simply, is a way to pass some types of legislation with a simple majority and avoid the threat of a filibuster, which requires 60 senators to overcome. Republicans have 53 seats in the Senate. They're not going to get any Democratic support, you know, to help get them over that 60-vote threshold. So what do? They turn to reconciliation. And that will make it possible to enact legislation on taxes and spending with just a simple majority. This is the same way that Democrats passed big parts of former President Biden's agenda. It is a complicated process. There are limits to what they can do. It's mainly about money, not major policy. And the first step is a budget resolution, which directs different committees to adjust spending or deficits. The committees all write their own bills, and then the budget committee puts them all together into one big bill that can't be filibustered.
Not the last we're going to hear about this, I'm sure. That's NPR's Barbara Sprun. Barbara, thanks.
Thank you.
Venus has clouds of sulfuric acid. Mercury has extremes of hot and cold. And then there's Mars. The red planet isn't exactly cozy, but it's a plausible place to go, though it will be difficult. And it's having a moment. Mars got a shout out in President Trump's inaugural address.
We will pursue our manifest destiny into the stars, launching American astronauts to plant the stars and stripes on the planet Mars.
President Trump is, of course, closely allied with would-be Mars colonizer Elon Musk. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on what all this might mean.
President Trump is hardly the first president to talk about
a journey to another planet, a manned mission to Mars.
That's the first President Bush in 1989, saying NASA should return astronauts to the moon and then proceed onward. Similar goals were set by President George W. Bush 15 years later.
Human missions to Mars and to worlds beyond.
President Obama directed NASA to forego the moon, but he did like Mars.
By the mid-2030s, I believe we can send humans to orbit Mars and return them safely to Earth. And a landing on Mars will follow.
During President Trump's first term in office, he issued Space Policy Directive 1. It refocused NASA on a moon landing, with Mars missions to follow later, and President Biden continued this program, which is called Artemis. Artemis relies on a super expensive rocket that rarely flies. There's been lots of delays and lots of speculation about its future. Casey Dreyer is chief of space policy with the Planetary Society. He says this administration could try to kill Artemis.
Whether that will happen, I'm less confident. There's a lot of good reasons to still go to the moon.
And since the Artemis program really got its start under President Trump, he thinks it would be strange for this second administration to end it. NASA says a capsule full of astronauts will orbit the moon next year. Landing on the moon is targeted for the year after that. But Dreyer says there's no clear path from this effort to Mars.
We say we have a moon to Mars program now, but there's no to Mars part of it. It's all to moon.
Enter Elon Musk, who's busy shaking up government agencies on President Trump's behalf. Musk has long held that if humans just stay on Earth, we risk extinction. Here's one speech from nearly a decade ago.
Eventually, history suggests there will be some doomsday event. The alternative is to become a spacefaring civilization and a multi-planet species.
Colonizing Mars is why he created SpaceX, the rocket company. In addition to ferrying astronauts to orbit for NASA, SpaceX is building a giant rocket and a vehicle called Starship that's designed to land on the red planet. Robert Zubrin is president of the Mars Society.
This is quite a singular moment for the prospects of getting to Mars.
He spent decades waiting for a Mars mission and views this as a moment of real opportunity, but also peril.
I think it actually is pretty clear right now that we're going to get a Humans to Mars program started.
The thing is, he says any such program to succeed would need broad bipartisan political support. And he worries that Musk has become a polarizing figure.
This is not going to work if this is understood to be a Elon Musk hobby horse.
Going to Mars is much harder than going to the moon. Just traveling to Mars takes months.
I do not believe there is any chance whatsoever of the Trump administration being able to land humans on Mars in the next 4 years.
Zubrin does think it's possible that SpaceX might land a Starship there, though so far in test flights, the rocket has yet to reach orbit. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Our look at influential black artists continues with the women who powered two of the most successful groups of all time, TLC and Destiny's Child. That's next time on Here and Now.
News stories do not wait to unfold. They just happen. And when they do, no matter where you are, NPR helps you stay connected. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org on your phone.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. Unprovoked shark attacks were down last year. Why would someone provoke a shark? Anyways, Florida's International Shark Attack File posts the numbers each year, and it logged 47 attacks worldwide last year, a nearly 32% decrease from the year before. The U.S. saw the highest number again with 28, the most being in Florida. Still, researchers want to remind people that the chances of being bitten by a shark remain incredibly low. Just don't provoke them. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The Trump administration has ordered prosecutors to drop criminal corruption and bribery charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. A Justice Department letter demanding the dismissal said the indictment was undermining the mayor's ability to cooperate with President Trump's immigration crackdown. Now, migrant communities are worried about what's to come, as John Campbell of member station WNYC reports from Albany.
Several dozen immigrants are rallying shoulder to shoulder inside the state capitol in Albany. They boarded buses from New York City at the crack of dawn to press Governor Kathy Hochul and state lawmakers on immigration issues. But the person who's really on their mind now is New York's mayor. Jax Gutierrez is with Make the Road New York, the group that organized the rally.
The Trump administration, with Mayor Eric Adams as a puppet, is working hard to deport and tear apart families.
Trump's Justice Department ordered prosecutors to drop bribery and fraud charges against Adams, while explicitly saying the decision wasn't based on the legal facts of the case. In the department's memo, the deputy attorney general said the charges were preventing Adams from devoting his full attention to combating illegal immigration, a major Trump initiative. Democratic State Assemblymember Karinas Reyes of the Bronx was at the event. She says the mayor is currying favor with Trump to save his own career.
It's been very clear that he's been cozying up to the Trump administration to save his own ass. And unfortunately, that's not the job of the mayor. The mayor of New York City's job is to protect New Yorkers. And we don't feel protected.
New York City is a sanctuary city. That means there's a local law in place preventing the NYPD from cooperating with federal immigration agents in most cases. And the mayor can't overturn it on his own. But the emphasis on immigration in the DOJ memo is concerning to advocates for migrants. Whitney Hu is with the group Churches United for Fair Housing, which works with migrants. She says the city has always been a beacon for immigrants, and she worries the mayor is turning his back on that.
We're seeing a real walk back of like what is meant to be a sanctuary city for New York City. And honestly, I'm just going to say, like, I think what it means to be a New Yorker.
Adams has cozied up to the Trump administration in recent weeks and reportedly told New York City officials to avoid criticizing the president or his policies. The mayor didn't directly address Trump's immigration stance in a brief speech following the DOJ memo, but he thanked the Justice Department for what he called its honesty.
Now we can put this cruel episode behind us and focus entirely on the future of our city.
Back in Albany, advocacy groups are worried. They're pushing for legislation that would prevent state and local authorities in New York from cooperating with ICE without a warrant signed by a judge. But the bill has stalled in the state legislature for more than 2 years. For his part, Mayor Adams faces a very tough re-election fight later this year. For NPR News, I'm John Campbell in Albany.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
A Midwestern land deal that once dealt a blow to housing discrimination.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Rubrik, dedicated to giving businesses the power to bounce back fast when cyber attacks target the cloud. More at rubrik.com.
I'm David Brancaccio in New York. First, inflation is a little like the scary movie where you think the monster's gone, but just when you think it is safe. There's news inflation is still creeping around, with the Consumer Price Index coming in slightly higher than expected this morning. Prices up 3% in the year through January. Prices of shelter spiked and eggs up 15% in January. You can only imagine what it'll be when this month comes in February. Meanwhile, the Guardian-in-Chief of Interest Rates, Jerome Powell, chair of America's Central Bank, is testifying for a second day on Capitol Hill now. Jeffrey Cleveland is chief economist at the investment firm Payden & Riegel, based in Los Angeles.
Policymakers, you know, what they tend to do is say they're not going to react too much to any one report. I think given the strength in the labor market, you know, we saw that last week with the 4% unemployment rate, the Fed can afford to be patient and wait to see if inflation does cool in subsequent months before making any other moves.
Markets, the Dow is down 274 points, 0.6%. The S&P is down 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 0.3%. Bonds tumbled on the inflation news, driving the 10-year interest rate up to 4.65%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive. Progressive Commercial Insurance protects small businesses from retailers to tradespeople. Progressive covers a variety of business needs with a range of coverages. More at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And by the Marketplace newsletter. No jargon, no hype, just smart takes on the economy. Marketplace.org/subscribe.
Let's talk about a key marketplace matter. Who got access to buying a house in America, a foundation of many families' generational wealth or lack thereof? Today, the first in a series called Unlocking the Gates on Housing and Economic Opportunity with Marketplace's special correspondent, Lee Hawkins. We start with a secret nighttime business deal, which unlocked the gates in one Minnesota suburb for dozens of black families seeking better schools and safer neighborhoods, including Lee's own family.
This is the house that I grew up in.
My parents moved my two sisters and me in 1975 when I was just 4 years old. Maplewood, a suburb of 25,000 people at the time, was more than 90% white. I recently learned that we were able to move here because of some shrewd moves by the couple who lived in the big house behind ours, James and Frances Hughes. In 1946, they found a white farmer willing to sell them 10 acres of land for $8,000. According to an interview with Francis, economic justice was their goal.
It was just after the war. There was a tremendous shortage of housing, and a great deal of new development was going on to try to fix that. But my dear, Negroes couldn't even buy a lot in these developments. They didn't even need deed restrictions to turn us away. They just refused to sell.
By the 1960s, the neighborhood had grown into a thriving black suburban community, one of the few of its kind in America.
In the 50s, Mr. Hughes decided he was going to let go of the farming, and it coincided with 94 going through the Rondo community and displacing, right, you know, those people.
That is Mrs. Ann Marie Rogers. Like so many other black communities across the country, Rondo was destroyed to make way for a highway. It was a forced removal. Mark Haynes was like a big brother to me. He took some bass guitar lessons from my dad and even ended up later playing bass for Janet Jackson. Since his family moved to Maplewood several years before mine, I called him to see what he remembered.
Yeah, it was a pretty tight-knit group of people. Every week, I think, they would meet, actually. It just felt like they seemed to be having a lot of fun, and I think there was an investment club, too.
Mr. Hughes's granddaughter, Carolyn Hughes-Smith, told us more about his vision for wealth building. But before he became a historical figure, he was just Grandpa.
The things that I really remember about him is he could whistle, like not whistle, but he could sing like a bird, you know, always just chirping.
She was aware of some of the difficulty he faced in completing that transaction that forever changed Maplewood.
What I heard later, of course, was that my grandpa was able to find someone that actually sold the land to him out there. And it, you know, and that's where it all started, really.
That someone was Frank Torek. His great-granddaughter, Davida Torek, is a California-based psychotherapist. When I tracked her down, she was astonished to hear the long-buried story.
When I received your email, it was quite shocking, like that somehow I could be a part of this amazing story of generational wealth.
Here's Jason Johnson, another childhood friend with the Minnesota musical connection. His aunt, Cynthia Johnson, was the lead singer of Lips, Inc., whose hit song, Funky Town, became a defining anthem of its time. I now know the bigger star was his grandmother.
They had told her that, well, you have to have so much money down by tomorrow for you to get this house. But my grandmother was, she was really smart, and her father was really smart. So he had her have savings bonds. So what she told him was, if you have it in writing, then I'll do my best to come up with the money. I don't know if I'd be able to. She was able to show up that day with all her savings bonds and everything and have the money to get it. And they were so mad that when she had got the house, they were so mad that, but they nothing that they could do legally because she had it on paper.
Hear Lee Hawkins tell the whole story, Unlocking the Gates, at Marketplace Online. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.